departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Is your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for the 40,000 Lakers fans who insisted on social media, oh yeah, they'll be there at the Lakers protest. Apparently 39,978 of them had the wrong day. 940 ESPN Fresno.com. Your 2 hour and 53 minute tour begins right now. 6 minutes, 23 seconds past the hour of 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel. Delighted to be with you another week here at 940 ESPN. And so much going on. So much happened this weekend. We're going to jump into all that. Also, one thing that didn't happen this weekend, we're talking about that in a couple of minutes, about yet another team that's not from a P5 program that didn't win a conference that somehow finds itself on the outside looking in to an NCAA tournament. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, happy Sharks fan, but now it's kind of come down a little bit because game two is tonight. Giants fan as well, Russ, keeping us going in the right direction. Game two coming up here, 5:30. Coverage begins today. And we'll have all your San Jose Sharks coverage right here on 940 ESPN on the program today. In about 28 minutes, Tony D will join me for his normal couple of segments and a little bonus Tony D time. Tony D logging more mileage than a professional baseball team lately, doing games all over the country. Tony is in demand. 4:35, the reason we started with the Lakers is because Alan Sliwa, our good friend from ESPN Los Angeles, host of Lakers Talk Mondays, 7 to 9 p.m., will join me. I sent a text to Alan a little bit earlier today, and I said to him, and this is pretty much word for word, do you ever go to bed at night wondering what kind of Lakers madness will I wake up to in the morning? And all he wrote back was one word, yes. I don't think anything else is needed. Also, top five at 5, and then, as I said, 5:30. We will have San Jose Sharks coverage for you, and the call of the game will, of course, go to the very capable and our very good friend Dan Rizanowski. That series is led by the Sharks, 1-0. They were winners on Saturday night, 6-3, up at the SAP Center over the Blues. You know, it's interesting, when you watch that game, Russ, and I know you were watching as well, and they pointed out on the broadcast a number of times that the teams hadn't played each other since, I think, November or December, early on, and you know, it was a very clean hitting game, and then, you know, it doesn't take long for things to start getting a little chippy. Start getting a little chippy and a little angry, and you start developing that healthy hockey playoff hatred early on. And I said in my preview, if you want to call it that, my prediction of this series, I thought that, and I'm obviously sticking with this, I thought that the Carolina would win on the East. They're down 2-0. They've given up a ton of goals to the Bruins. But I did believe the Sharks would win this series, and I do. I think the one area that I like the Sharks' offense a little better. I like the Blues' defense a little better. One thing that concerned me is the physicality of the Blues, a little bit more physical than the Sharks, which is not to say the Sharks aren't, but it's something that the Blues rely on a little bit more. But I do like the Sharks, and I like the Sharks tonight as well. But that was a great game on Saturday night, no question about it. And we'll hear what's going on tonight from Mr. Dan Rizanowski. And then I'm just a little housekeeping. I'm out tomorrow, but I will be back on Wednesday. Wednesday, we're not really sure how long the program is going to be because we have the Giants game. We have the Giants game to begin with, and then we will come in after the Giants game. And you know how this works. It could be 3:30, could be 4 o'clock, 4:10. It really depends what it is. A couple of Giants games ago that we got preempted by. The game just flew by. It was 2-1 or 3-1. It was a very quick game, and we were in very early. The last game that this happened was last week. It was a 12-11 Colorado Rockies win over the Giants, and we didn't get in until about 4:35, about 4:40 or so. So we've got that going on Wednesday. But then at 4:30, we have Game 3 coverage, Sharks and Blues from St. Louis. So I'm not sure if the show is going to be an hour, if it's going to be 45 minutes, if it's going to be 30 minutes. Add to that, we were scheduled on Wednesday to be out at the airport and to do a combo platter of this program and then Paul Leffler jumping in and talking, of course, about Honor Flight. This is a flight, I believe this is all Vietnam veterans coming back on this flight. So we're going to figure this all out today and tomorrow. And we'll have something to share. I mean, there's going to be a program. It's a question of how long it's going to be, and then there'll be a question of, you know, what we're going to be able to do relative to Honor Flight. We'll get that all figured out going forward. So the NCAA college softball season, the regular season, has ended. And a quick check of your – just stay with me on this now, because you may already know. I'm going to bury the lead here a little bit. I sort of gave the lead earlier. But I'm going to bury it right now. A quick look at your final standings in the Mountain West Conference. Colorado State wins. Solid team. They win the Mountain West 18-6 overall, 38-10. All right. In second is San Jose State at 17-7, 37-16 overall. I know it's a lot of numbers. You don't need to worry about the numbers yet. I'm going to give you a couple of key numbers in a moment. Coming in third in the Mountain West, it's not like I'm doing a horse race, don't I? UNLV, 14-9 in the conference, 36-14 overall. Your fourth place Mountain West finisher, Fresno State, 14-10, 36-18 overall. And then tied for fifth, Boise State and San Diego State, but we'll concern ourselves with Boise State. Let me say it again. Fifth place, Boise State comes in fifth place with a 12-12 conference record, 34-14 overall. Colorado State winning the Mountain West, they have, of course, an automatic invite to the NCAA softball tournament championship, as it were. San Jose State comes in second. They do not get an invite. UNLV comes in third. They do not get an invite. Fresno State comes in fourth. They do not get an invite. Boise State comes in fifth. They get an invite. They're going to be in the Gainesville Regional, which is being hosted by the Florida Gators. So when I saw this, my first thought was, this is a little ridiculous. So I took a look at some numbers. I was talking with someone on Twitter, and the conversation immediately, and as it should, goes to RPI. So where are these teams at relative to RPI? Well, let me just pull up I've got so many different papers and things here. Let me see if I can find it. I don't know where it is now. It's here somewhere. Heaven's sakes. All right. As you would imagine, I can't find it. So I'm gonna have to look for it now because I had it here a second ago. I won't bury the lead any further. My concern, and I finally have the numbers, my concern is that in too many NCAA selection committees, what ends up happening is once you get past the numbers, regardless of where those numbers are, the various championship selection committees are more concerned with name value, with marquee name value, with some sort of recognition than they are the reality of how teams have finished and played. So let's look at RPI. Boise State, a very solid and respectable 40. Boise State, 40. UNLV, their RPI was 46. San Jose State was 48. Fresno State's was 61. All right. Out of those four, again, only Boise State gets an NCAA tournament bid. But apparently, how you do in your conference means absolutely nothing. The reason I say that is because think of the three teams I just mentioned, Fresno State, UNLV, and San Jose State, all finished above Boise State. All of them have a lower RPI, but San Jose State swept Boise State this year. UNLV won 2 of 3. And then this past series, the final series, Fresno State swept Boise State, and Fresno State annihilated them. They outscored them 20-6. So you have a team that goes 500 in the conference. In other words, a worse conference record than the three teams. We'll take Colorado State out because they're the champions. They a worse record than the 2, 3, and 4 teams in the conference. And out of the nine games that Boise State played, Fresno State, UNLV, and San Jose State, Boise State loses 8 of them. They lose 8 of them. And yet somehow, incredibly, Boise State gets a bid. I'm at a loss to understand it. I legitimately am a loss to understand it because the only thing I can think of is, and I for those of you who've never heard the program, who are joining it for the first time, I know there's some of you out there, wherever you happen to be listening to us, here in California or around the country, I'm going to remind it, folks, again. I'm not from Fresno. I didn't go to Fresno State. So I don't have a Bulldogs agenda. Yes, we are the flagship of Fresno State, but at the end of the day, do I want Fresno State to do well in sports? Heck yes. Will I lose sleep the way my colleagues here who went to Fresno State often do when something bad happens to the Bulldogs? No. No. I don't have that emotional connection. And plus what I do, I just don't. But this is wrong. Because clearly this was end of discussion, end of story, before Fresno State even played Boise State. How can you take a team that goes 34-14, 12-12 in the conference, get swept by a team? That team finishes 36-18, 14-10. How can you take that team over them? Boise State against nationally ranked teams went 2-2. They lost their one game that they played to Texas, and then they won a game against Colorado State. So they went 2-2 against top 25 teams. Fresno State went 0-6. They lost a 3-game series to Colorado State. They lost 2 games at 2 different times to number 1 UCLA. Right now, they, in terms of the RPI, UCLA is 5th. On the year, they're 46-5. And the other game they lost was to, at the time, number 7 Tennessee. Tennessee's RPI is 15. And this actually doesn't include a couple of games for over the weekend, excuse me. But so Fresno State going 0-6 against top 25 teams, no, it's not great. But the double-edged sword of that is they played 6 games against top 25 teams. Boise State played 4, better record against top 25 teams, better RPI, but against 3 teams that were ahead of them that did not get bids, all the teams better conference records, all the teams better overall records, and every one of them beat them in a series, 3 straight, 3 straight, 2 out of 3. The 5th place team in the Mountain West gets a bid, and Fresno State does not. However, it doesn't end there. If you really want to extend this out a little bit, let's look at one more team that made it in. Here is where I'm just completely, utterly dumbfounded at the NCAA. I know that most of you probably don't pay attention to Texas A&M. Certainly not Texas A&M softball. But I'm going to tell you what Texas A&M softball did. First of all, Texas A&M got a bid. Texas A&M got a bid. Big-time school. College Station, big-time football program, great facilities. Every facility at Texas A&M is elite. You know, the Aggies, everybody knows the name Texas A&M. They got a bid. Do you know how Texas A&M did this year in the Southeastern Conference in softball? The Southeastern Conference has 14 teams. There are 13 that play softball. What place do you think Texas A&M came in the SEC this year? If you said 13th place, you would be correct. Just to be clear, the Aggies came in 13th place out of 13 teams. Now, the SEC is the premier conference in college softball. They don't win the championship every year, certainly not. But between the SEC, the Big 12, the Pac-12, I'll go even amend it and say you can make an argument that the SEC is the premier conference. Between them and the Big 12 and the Pac-12, it's, you know, flip three coins. They're all elite. Having said that, Texas A&M went 6-18 in the conference. 6-18. Their overall record was 28-25. They had an RPI of 50. Their RPI was 50. What that means is that they had a worse RPI than UNLV and San Jose State, two teams that finished much better in their respective conference, much better record. Throw in Fresno State, which was 10 notches below Texas A&M. Texas A&M, again, 28-25. Fresno State, 36-18. Somehow Texas A&M gets a bid. I mean, they had to play a play-in game in the SEC tournament to get into the full SEC tournament. What do you think they did? Of course they lost. 13th place, 6-18 in the conference, 28-25 overall, an RPI of 50, lower than two teams, better records, you know, better RPIs, better everything, and just a little bit above Fresno State. All three of those teams don't get in, but marquee name, big-time school, a school that's had many NCAA bids, Texas A&M gets in. There's not a person on any selection committee in the NCAA that can convince me that name value, marquee name value, doesn't count. Because if they were looking at this logically, there isn't any imaginable way that a Texas A&M should get into this tournament. Tell me, what have they done in 28-25, 6-18 in the conference, finishing in dead last place, that gives them a bid to the NCAA tournament? But enough about Texas A&M. Back to Boise State. And this, you know, my thought about Boise State, it's not this, you know, the rampant anti-Boise State, I hate Boise because I'm in Fresno. It's none of that. It's by the numbers. Boise was swept, hammered by Fresno State. They were swept by San Jose State. They lose 2 of 3 to UNLV. They lose 8 of 9 to the three teams ahead of them, all with better records. In conference, all with better overall records. But the only thing that jumps out is that Boise State had an RPI of 40. Boise State has a nationwide marquee name because of football, and there's the recognition. We'll give them a bid. Their RPI is 40. It's not going to really matter what they do against Fresno State this weekend. Oh, what's that? What happened? They lost all three games. They gave up 20 runs. One of the games that got shortened by the run rule. I'm sorry, but I think Linda Garza's team got it stuck to them by the NCAA. And I'll even go as far as to say, if not Fresno State, then UNLV or San Jose State should have gotten a bid. I think Fresno State should have gotten a bid. But when you are giving a fifth place team in a conference a bid, I'm trying to understand what I'm missing. Beyond RPI, what exactly am I missing here? What exactly am I missing with Texas A&M, 28-25, a terrible team, last place in a P5 conference, they get a bid over UNLV, San Jose State, and Fresno State, but right there with them is Boise State. I'm sorry, there's just something wrong with that. Okay, so Fresno State got into this national invitation tournament, and that's great. And it's great. Those young ladies deserve postseason action. There's no question about it. But I'm sorry. That's just ridiculous. You want to weigh in? You certainly can. 844-940-3776. If you think that there is a bias from NCAA selection committees, you're right. It's the Christopher Gabriel Program.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Coming up in the next couple of minutes, we're going to talk with Tony D. We'll talk Warriors. We've got the audio of the incredible, really unforgettable shot by Kawhi Leonard for the Toronto Raptors to take out the 76ers in Game 7. But the call we're going to give you is not going to be the call from TNT. It's not going to be the Raptors radio call. It's not going to be the 76ers radio call. We're going to give you something a little bit different. We're going to give you a call from one of the international broadcasts that is just memorable and fantastic. Just some amazing basketball this past weekend. And I'm going to say I told you so. I said it on Friday morning that the Warriors were going to win Game 6. They said they were going to win Game 6. That going into that game, when Steph Curry plays, when I didn't say on the air, but going into that game, when Curry plays and Durant doesn't, the Warriors going into Game 6 were 21-1 overall since he's been here. When Durant doesn't play, period, no matter who's playing, they were 30-10. They won a championship without Kevin Durant. They were going to be able to step up. It took a while for Curry to get going, but basically one half, and then he just lit it up in the second half, getting 33 all in the second half. There was never a doubt in my mind that they would find a way to come out and everybody would step up. Who knew that they were going to get the kind of bench production that they did? But Klay Thompson set the tone early. Andre Iguodala played great. Draymond Green played exceptionally well. And Steph Curry did what he does. That team, and I said this on Twitter, they know how to win. When it's winning time, it's game on. And once again, the Rockets have failed. This is the team that said they wanted them all year. From last year, the Rockets said, we want the Warriors. They got them. They're going home again. What does this do to James Harden's legacy? Well, James Harden's only, 29, 28 years old? His legacy is ongoing and not complete. But and that, you know, you'll recall also the Warriors, I believe they got kicked off the court on Thursday. Chris Paul and company came out and said, you know, it's our time. And, Warriors There's no better team in the NBA that can put a dagger in you right now than the Golden State Warriors. And then you've got the boys on TNT, Charles Barkley, guaranteeing the Blazers are going to win. Blazers are not going to win this series. Oh, I love watching the Portland Trail Blazers play basketball. McCollum and Lillard are just a fun tandem to watch. I'm glad they won. I wanted to see these teams play each other. Portland is a really exciting team, and I think this series is going to go seven. I've seen predictions of five. I saw one of four. No. This is not going to be a four-game sweep for anybody. But this has the potential to be an absolutely terrific series. A couple of arenas, you know, in the Moda Center up there in Portland, and, of course, Oracle in Oakland. Two incredibly engaged, deafening crowds that love their team. Every series it's the final, potentially the final game when it's an elimination game or the final series. And that's something that I think is not lost on the Warriors as they get ready to move across the bridge to the Chase Center. So this is going to be some fun basketball. Looking forward to getting your thoughts from Tony D coming up. Glad you're hanging out with us. It is Monday. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Before we get to Tony D, Jay weighing in, you can always tweet me at CG Program. NCAA has no business selecting which teams will participate in its tourneys, not when the NCAA stands to make more money through higher ratings and TV contracts from marquee matchups. Selections should be made by independent party. NCAA inclusion criteria, a moving target. I can't say that I disagree with that, and I know it sounds a little bit crazy to some who maybe don't pay attention that much to how these things are done and carried out and selected. But what Jay is saying is really on target. Because, again, I'm going to ask Tony about this, when you get past the numbers and you look at the other numbers in terms of the actual conference standings and the head-to-head, and you see that Boise State loses 8 of 9 to UNLV, San Jose State, and Fresno State, And they get absolutely pounded by Fresno State. Boise State is in. Fresno State nor UNLV and San Jose State are in. Texas A&M, 28-25. Last place in the SEC. They can't even win a play-in game against another miserable team, Mississippi State. And yet they get in. Good time to bring in our good friend Tony D. Tony, I know you've been traveling a lot. How are you, my friend?
Fine, a little jet lag, but do it. By the way, very happy that Portland won, because you know this, old world traveler, that heading into Denver is a lot tougher than heading into Portland, particularly when you're trying to land a plane in mile-high winds, okay?
Well,
so I'm just saying, the Warriors are very pleased, too. They didn't want to go back to the altitude, so I'm delighted that the way it's going to look in the West.
Well, you're right, and I'm going to say it's not new anymore, but the newish Denver Airport, the cool architectural design with the spires that are supposed to look like the Rockies. That's about an hour.
You're close. You might as well drive home from there.
Yes,
that's the joke. Yes.
Yeah, you might as well be
say,
in the Rockies. Do you want to go to
the guy saying, bring back Stapleton. Bring back.
Yes,
Stapleton.
I mean if you land at Denver's airport, you're a 10-minute drive from Wyoming. I mean, you're right. So
you're
the
right.
Altitude, all of that, and I was saying, we'll get to this in a minute. I was saying I think this is going to be a great series. I love that Portland team. I love McCollum. Boy, what a game he had, and Lillard. This is going to be a lot of fun. A couple of really exciting teams. One a little bit older, but also a lot more experienced, and a championship team. One young team that's going to be there for a long time. Two great fan bases, two great buildings, Tony.
Well, yeah, you're right about that. I mean, Oracle could have faced their last game, as you know, last week, but the Warriors won there, and then, of course, won in Houston. But, yeah, the Moda Center, it's a great place. Those fans, I mean, you know this so well, in Portland, the Blazers are truly the only show in town. I mean, I know they have professional soccer there, but, you know, baseball is not prominent. They're not big enough market for anything but the NBA, and they love their Blazers, and there's no doubt. And also, you're well aware that there's a certain guard who went to Weber State that grew up about a mile from Oracle, and he would love to beat the hometown team.
Yeah.
You think Chris Paul doesn't like the Warriors. Damian Lillard really doesn't like the Warriors. So, and look, Rodney Hood dodged a bullet himself because he's not seriously injured, and Durant will probably be out for the two games at Oracle for sure. Portland should make this a very interesting series.
Well,
that's for sure.
I want to talk. I'm going to push this back a segment or so. I want to talk about Fresno State softball with you a little bit, but I want to stay with this as long as we're talking about it right now. I say this lovingly that I told you so. I told you that.
I know you did, man. Absolutely.
But not
afterward. I should add, you're not one of those guys who told me afterward. It's what we talked about with Tark when they went to play Duke the second time around in 91. Tark said, "We're not ready to play this game." Not we weren't ready. We're not. He said it before the semifinal game started. Okay.
No,
unfortunately, was right.
Yeah, and I said it on the program on Friday. But more seriously, what's interesting about this, Tony, there were so many members of the national media that were not only, I mean, they were just dismissing the Warriors with any chance of winning, and they were talking national guys, broadcasters and writers, assuming Game 7, and I think they were forgetting a couple of things. One, this team has four All-Stars on it. I mean, you've got two of the greatest backcourt shooters that have ever played in the National Basketball Association. You have a team that understands how to get up for a game when they really need it. And you have a team, the other team, the fellas in red, that have never shown, not in the last 5 years, that when it was time to be a primetime player, the Houston Rockets have gone home.
You're right about that. And look, since you brought it up, I love Charles Barkley. He's tremendously entertaining. But Chuck has one quirk that drives me out of my mind, and it's this. He'll make a statement, however outrageous it might be. Then he'll call the rest of the national pundits idiots, which we talked about last week, if you remember.
Yep.
But case in point with this Warrior deal, he said going into Game 6, with Durant then losing, the Warriors losing Durant into the fourth quarter, Barkley said after that game, there was no way that the Warriors, or excuse me, Game 5, there's no way the Warriors should have won that game. No way, and they cannot win this series. They cannot win it. Houston will win Game 6 and will win Game 7, period. That's what he said, that the Warriors can't go anywhere without Durant. Then after the Warriors win, instead of doing the normal thing, which is to say this, I was wrong. It was just an opinion. I was wrong. The Warriors are the better team. What does he say? Well, I didn't know that Houston was going to lay down like dogs.
That's right.
All right. Now, here's the problem with that, CG. You're playing both sides against the middle. You're saying my prediction is wrong, not because I was wrong, but rather the team that I said would win let me down, and that is part of the process of figuring out who is going to play well, right? You can't say, well, you know what, they should have. If you want to do that, then at the start of the year, let's just talk about who's better and just give them the title. Because it's what you and I talked about this over and over again. Remember I told you the guys pick up the guy who says, hey, you know what, I can do this, I can, my buddy can. Show me. How about that? Show me on the court. Don't tell me how good you are. Show me on the court. The Rockets had the advantage. They did not play well enough to win. Barkley was wrong in his prediction. He can't blame it on the Rockets. He read the situation incorrectly.
No, you're right.
That's what irritates me.
Yeah, no,
a lot.
You're right, because you listen to Barkley, and I'm a Barkley fan too.
I love the guy.
Yeah,
but it's just craziness to take that stance.
Yeah, that's no,
all.
Exactly.
You can't lose. You can't be wrong then, right? You're either right or the team did you in. Therefore, you were right and they were wrong, and that's not how predictions work.
That's right, because you don't come on and this is essentially what you said. I mean, you don't come on and say, well, I predicted this, but it's not a but. It's one of the reasons they laid an egg is because the Warriors were so good. The Warriors, in the final 24 minutes, took it to them. They took the play to them. And you look at the shots that Steph Curry made and the plays they made and the second effort that they made and getting 50-50 balls and doing everything they had to do, they elevated their game in a way that Houston was not able to do, and they certainly weren't able to do last year when it was 3-2, when ostensibly, well, we would have won if we would have had Chris Paul. Well, this time you had Chris Paul. The Warriors didn't have Kevin Durant, and you still lost. And that was the opening for Charles Barkley to come out and say, boy, did I underestimate this team. They went out there with the greatest player in the world right now, and they took it to him, but he didn't say that. And that's where he loses points with me, because as bold as he wants to be, and he gets into his hole, they're a bunch of knuckleheads, all these idiots in the net. Well, Charles, you know what? Emperor's new clothes. I mean, that's what we have going here.
Well, particularly when Kitty Smith tried to give him the rope. He could have thrown him the boat anchor. He threw him the life preserver. He said, but Charles, didn't the Warriors play a great game? Yeah. They were good. But see, here's the whole thing. And when you do that, you do lose credibility. And I love Charles. He's a great guy. He's a great person, period. And he does a lot to promote the game. But there is a certain point. I guess what it comes down to, CG, and you know this from playing the game yourself, you get some guys, and you've heard them, I'm sure, they'll go, he's not better than me, he's just taller than me.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of him being better. Just like he can't say to you, you're not better than me, you're just smaller and quicker than me. Then that's part of you being better than him. That's part of the deal. Figuring out whether a team is mentally ready to play the game as an expert, isn't that part of what you have to factor in to your analysis going into a game? Don't you have to take into account what you're talking about? That this group, the Houston team, has historically failed the way the Clippers failed under Chris Paul. I'm not saying it's always Chris Paul's fault, but you do have to factor that in. And if you're going to say afterward, I ignored that, and therefore it's their fault, I would say it's your fault for ignoring the obvious in front of you.
Well, Kenny Smith has said it on TNT's coverage, and our guy Charles has said it. They've made the point.
I know what you're going to say about the Blazers.
The whole Blazers prediction kills me. But they've both said they have both said in a seven game series the best team wins. That's why seven game series are great. You're not going to get a fluke winner. The best team wins. And you can't suddenly qualify that and say, well, the best team always wins, but not this time because I predicted Houston. And it just, he's wrong about that. And then he's guaranteeing a Portland win. And it's almost, maybe he's got, a little issue with the Warriors. I'm not really sure.
Barkley has an issue with the Warriors because this goes back to the 14-15 year. He said a jump shooting team would never win an NBA title, and they won it. And then the next year against Cleveland, he pounded the drum throughout the 73-win season. The Warriors weren't going to win it. He turned out to be right for all the wrong reasons in the last 4 minutes of that Game 7, right? Because they did have a 3-1 lead. Give Cleveland due credit. But Barkley banged that drum, and when the Warriors then got Durant, he felt that they, like a lot of people felt, gamed the system. And so it took his dislike of jump shooting teams to a whole new level. And it's funny when you listen to him, because every once in a while the truth slips out and you go, well, they're one of the best teams of all time. And then he goes right back again to his incredible dislike of the Warriors as an entity right now. And it does paint his attitude.
And it does bear mentioning that both Tony and myself love that show. Inside the NBA is one of the great studio shows
there is.
One of the things I love about the show is when they're doing highlights, thankfully, they keep the music bed low and they allow them to just have their own little insights and comments and quips and things. And it's great. And each one of those three guys along with Ernie, all four of them, have their own specific role. They each play the role well. You know that they genuinely like each other, and that's what resonates, because as much grief as they give each other, it's all based on the fact that they have such respect for each other. It's along with ESPN's College Game Day, my two favorite studio shows on TV.
Well, you're right, and I'll tell you this about Barkley. Through all of the outrageous statements, he's the quickest guy to laugh at himself, right? You'll see it. He'll be angry at Shaq, and Shaq will say, you know what, I make a lot more money. I'm Mr. O'Neal, that kind of stuff, right? you know, Barkley said, well, when me and Kenny walk in the bank, they stand up for us too. And Shaq says, I don't need to go to the bank. They bring the money to me, right?
Okay. Yes.
Charles starts laughing with everybody. You know that everything he does, he understands the entertainment value of it. And that's just the reality of it. And look, an opinion is an opinion, but I think it is fair to say if you've got an opinion and you're wrong, don't blame it on the team's failure, because one more time, that's something you should have factored in. And it's something that you talked about. Again, I'll give you all credit, because CG said this to me before Friday's game. The Rockets aren't up to it. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter that Durant is out. Doesn't matter the games in Houston. You flat out told me the Warriors will win because they are the better team and Houston is not up to the task. That's factoring in the liability of that club. If you would have waited till afterward and said, well, you know what? They weren't up to it. That's why they let me down. I would have said, well, then you should have figured that out going in, right. Which you did, you know.
That's exactly right. Coming up, Tony and I, we have a lot to talk about, a lot of NBA stuff to talk about. And 4:35 today, I'm going to be talking with our guy in Los Angeles, at ESPN Los Angeles, Alan Sliwa. Tony probably hasn't heard this yet, but I'll throw this out there again. I sent a text to Alan Sliwa earlier today saying, do you go to bed at night wondering what kind of Lakers madness you're going to wake up to every morning? And he said, yes. That's all he said was yes. But we're going to talk more NBA. We'll talk San Jose Sharks. I want to talk about the NCAA selection committees as well. My guest, as always, every Monday is Tony D. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
You can always email me, cgp@940espnfresno.com. Tony, this is an email I just got in the little quotation marks, as if Charles Barkley is talking. Mike Tyson would have won if he wasn't knocked out by Buster Douglas.
That's right. That's right. If his mouthpiece weren't in his nostril, he would have been fine. It restricted his breathing to have half the mouthpiece out
gosh.
Of his mouth. Yeah, I told you my dad, right? Told you my dad's line. If the rabbit wouldn't have stopped to take it, you know what? He would have won the race. Okay, fine, Dad. Thank you.
It's very simple.
A lot of advice, you know, that don't go out in your socks in the rain and don't let anybody use your comb. Then he sent me off into the real world. So there you go.
A couple minutes to close this hour. The Denver series, this was one that I got right ahead of time. But you know what? I thought I was going with Portland, I think only because I wanted Portland to win. But I thought, you know, the Nuggets are so tough at home, they're not going to lose a seventh game on their home court. And they did. Portland just... Are you surprised at all that Portland went in there and did that to them in Game 7?
Well, particularly given the fact that Denver was probably one run away, 1 5-7 point run away from breaking contact. I mean, they had the Blazers by the scruff of the neck in that first half and couldn't put them away. That's what surprised me. I thought that they would go ahead and win, but you have a 17-point lead and it evaporates on you. And then, you know, it gets down to one possession here or there, and that backcourt for Portland can carry the day. And McCollum was just, as you mentioned, just unbelievable.
He is quite a player. And I don't when he said that his block late in the game, in the fourth quarter, was Braun-like, that he wasn't kidding. I mean, he came all the way and got that and took that shot, you know, before it got to the backboard. That was an amazing play by McCollum.
It was, and I'm sure that Iguodala is so sick. Somebody brings anything up, they roll the video of Braun blocking Iggy in Game 7 at the Coliseum. Yeah, it was a great play by McCollum. Who really, look, it wasn't a great shooting day for Lillard. He had that one big three late, but he gave the opportunity to McCollum, and the one thing about CJ, he's not afraid. You know that, and he proved it again.
What chance do you give Portland in the series? Or I don't know where you're at, even though I know you're a Warriors fan. Maybe I should rephrase it and say, what do you like, who do you like in this series?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with what happens with Durant, obviously. He's definitely out for game one. Kerr implied they probably will rest him for game two. The proviso may be if the Warriors lose game one. Also, keep in mind, these series now, for the first time, they've adopted the National Hockey League deal every other day. I like that.
Me too.
You know, that's what the National Hockey League does. Every other day, it'll be a conference final. I think the Warriors will win it, but I'll tell you what, they better be careful without Durant early on. Hood evidently is going to be okay. I think the Warriors have enough. I love Portland, though. I think it'll be a good series. I think the Warriors have enough in six or seven to win.
Yeah, I'm going Warriors in seven. More with Tony D coming up. We're going to talk about Toronto and Philadelphia, and we've got the call on the final shot, but it's a different call. Maybe it's one you haven't heard. It's the call that was made by the South Korean broadcast crew. And again, if you've not heard it, you don't want to miss this. Tony D continues to join me in hour number two. This is the CGP.
The studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP begins right now. 5 minutes, 28 seconds past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Glad to have you aboard. Going to 5:30 today and then San Jose Sharks hockey. Tomorrow, I am out of here. I'm off to tomorrow, but on Wednesday, I'll be live at the airport. We will be coming on after the Giants game. We will run you through 5:30, and then 5:30, Paul Loeffler will come on. The San Jose Sharks game will start on 7:90, and then at 6 p.m., it is scheduled to switch over to 9:40. That's the plan that we have in place right now. Should it change for any reason, you will be the first to know. We are talking with our good friend Tony D. Sixers Raptors game, that became a game. I don't think I'm going too far in saying a game for the ages. And the way these two great teams went back and forth, I want everybody to hear the final shot. Of course, the final shot, Kawhi Leonard gets it. He goes deep to the right corner with about 4.5 seconds left, drains a shot on a ball that bounces on the rim. What seemed like for 10 minutes, something straight out of Hollywood. Here's the call, but this is the South Korean call.
눈을 뗄 수 없는 명경기가 펼쳐지고 있습니다. 웨터스의 공격. 가솔 레너드에게 시간 떨어집니다. 3초, 2초, 1초, 레너드! 들어! 와! 카와이 레너드! 와! 믿을 수가 없습니다. 들어갔어요! 들어갑니다! 와! 시리즈로 이런 샷으로 끝냅니다. 카와이 레너드! 이게 NBA죠! 이게 NBA죠! 와. 믿을 수가 없습니다! 정말 미라클 샷입니다!
Well, that, if you've never heard Tony D do play-by-play, it sounds very similar.
I'm just going to say, I've had guys like that next to me, okay, who took the soundboard away because they thought it was a little bit too encumbersome.
Yes! That play, you know, we're getting a lot of post-game analysis now on what Joel Embiid, what the Sixers should have done, and I think it's pretty clear they could have cut off his path a little bit. But you know what? When you're in that situation, it's a lot easier to say it after it happens than before it would have happened.
Well, particularly the last thing in the world you want, because you're in the bonus, is to be whistled for a foul.
Yeah.
What the Sixers ought to do, and you already know what I'm going to say. They take a look at those three consecutive empty possessions where they ran the shot clock down to nothing and got two violations and an air ball. I mean, I have never seen a team in that situation have three terrible possessions in a row where they had no chance to score. It's one thing to throw it away. It's another, CG, to use up the 24 and just get nothing. I have no idea what they were doing in those possessions.
No, I'm with you, and I don't know what it says about a team when you look at the talent they have on this team, but you look at the various makeups of each individual player, and Jimmy Butler ends up being the play that you thought was going to be the big play that might propel them to overtime and then possibly a Sixers win, or maybe they get another possession. But Ben Simmons, you know, he's a great player. He's a great point guard, but he's a liability as a shooter. It's a little bit like Lonzo. Joel Embiid, there were times in the final, I don't know, 6-7 minutes, maybe a little bit more. There were times, Tony, I don't know if you had this impression, that his inexperience on the big stage in the biggest moment was very clear. You could see it in his body language. You could see it in his facial expressions. There were times that I just didn't get a feeling of confidence that he was going to be a guy to make a big play.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that deferring going on, and they couldn't figure out exactly where to position a guy like Embiid and then whether to go through him or not. I'll tell you this, from a Warrior fan point of view, I was disappointed because I had hoped that Philly was going to get through, not just so we could have the new Warriors and the old Warriors, because, you know, that's where the franchise came from, but the Warriors would have kept home court. Now the one thing we know for sure, the East, for the first time in a long time since the Warriors started this run, the East will have home court advantage because Milwaukee and Toronto were the 1-2 records. The Warriors were third. So we know no matter what, the East is finally going to start the NBA Finals at home. I don't know if it'll make a difference or not, but it is an interesting note.
Do you believe there was a lot of talk, and a lot of these comments have come back, and I'm probably going to share some of them during Top 5 at 5 today, Tony, but there was talk from the Sixers hierarchy that they need to go further in the playoffs this year, and technically they did by going a couple of games further than they went against Boston last year. I'm not sure that Brett Brown should be a fall guy. He's a smart basketball mind. He's had some moving pieces. He gets Butler midseason, and I think you need to give Brett Brown one more year at least. Certainly to see what's going to happen in the offseason, who's going to be left on this Sixers team, who are they going to keep, which free agents are going to leave. I think the Sixers are one of those teams that not a lot is being said unless you want to buy into the Simmons for LeBron James trade that's being thrown out there by various executives. And I'll say this about that, Tony. I want you to comment on all this. There was a time, probably a few months ago, that had you said to me, on either my program or yours, what do you think about the idea of LeBron changing places with Ben Simmons? I would have thought that's crazy. Now, Tony, I'm not so sure when you consider what is going on. I mean, right now the Lakers hierarchy, it's like Richard III. It's gotten to a point where it's the worst case scenario in a classic Shakespearean tragedy playing out, where who's making the decision? Is it Richard? Is it one of his? Is it Bolingbroke? Who is it? And you look at the Lakers, you have to wonder what's going on, and you have to wonder, where's LeBron's head at right now, Tony?
Well, particularly, and you brought this up a little bit earlier, but you know, Chris Paul, and where is he at right now? Because he has this huge deal, almost $40 million a year, but he's not getting any younger. He's seeing the clock start to run out. LeBron, same situation. The immediacy is there, and you look around you, and I'll tell you this, CG. We talk about coaches being in trouble. Tillman Fertitta, the owner of the Rockets, was apoplectic after the game the other night. Actually got up and walked off before the game ended, and they stopped him in the hallway. You can't tell me that he's not equal doses angry at Mike D'Antoni and at Daryl Morey at the same time. There are a lot of teams. The Lakers are this way. The Sixers are this way. They have strangled themselves in caponomics, and they have virtually no way to go out and improve their team now. Outside of a monster deal, a monster trade, they have capped themselves out. And with Philly, if I'm Brett Brown, the first thing I'm saying is we don't have enough shooting. We have one guy in Redick, and that's it that we can rely on. But where are you going to find the rest of the guys when you don't have the money? With the Lakers, you tell me, with what they're spending, what can the Lakers do? They can clear room to go after the big free agents, but if they don't get them, CG, what are they going to do to improve this roster? That's the question.
Yeah, they're in trouble, and I hope if you have a few minutes, you listen into 435. Alan Sliwa, our very good friend who's the host of Lakers Talk, is going to come on, and I can hear it in his voice already, and he's not even on the air yet. He just must be out of his mind with what's going on down there, because he's always...
Well, what happened, CG? Let me ask you, I don't mean to interrupt, but seriously, if you're in Lakerland, and you're saying, okay, let's say that for the sake of argument, Durant and Kyrie are going to New York, and there's plausibility in that, right? There's no doubt. And the better the Warriors play, the more KD is probably saying to himself, you know what, I can't win here. I won twice. I have MVPs, and I'm still universally reviled. I got to go do this somewhere else. Kyrie has all but talked his way out of Boston the way he is acting. If those two guys go there, and if Kawhi Leonard wants nothing to do with the Lakers, if it's either stay in Toronto where they can get him a lot more money or go to L.A. in the relative anonymity but more solid ownership of the Clippers, if those three guys go elsewhere, are the Lakers all dressed up and know where to go? What are they going to do with all this cap room? You can't spend it on. You can't spend a ton of money on Bradley Beal. That's not going to solve your problem. What do you do if you have strangled yourself in the way of depth and you can't get the top-heavy guys? What are you going to do?
I'll start with I'll answer that first with a moment of levity, and then I'll answer more seriously, because I put this on Twitter today, and I said, out of the K's that are available on the will he go to the Lakers scorecard, and I put Kawhi, no. Clay, no. Kemba, no. Kyrie, maybe. Kershaw. Short move from Dodger Stadium to Staples Center.
is that right?
Maybe he just wants a change
of
scenery.
Maybe he can stay healthy doing that.
Maybe you never
that's
know.
The deal.
Now,
okay.
More seriously, to your question, I think the Lakers are hamstrung here. And you look at 2 years ago when we knew that LeBron James was coming to Los Angeles, and the idea that he was going to go play with his good friend Chris Paul was never a possibility. That he was getting floated going to Philadelphia, that at the time was never a possibility. He wasn't going to stay in Cleveland because we knew that he wanted to start growing his film company, his business, and no better place to do that than being in Los Angeles. But what's happened since then, I don't think anybody could predict. With the injuries and with the fact that they missed the playoffs, it was almost a given that they were going to make the playoffs as probably a 7 or 8 seed. Christmas Day, you'll recall, they go to Oracle.
Oh, very well.
Yeah, they beat the Warriors. They're 20-14. They're on pace to win 48 games, which would have gotten them probably a number 7 seed, at worst an 8 seed. But now, as you correctly point out, they are in the proverbial rock hard place situation. And if I'm Kyrie, okay, yeah, I can come back to L.A., but do you really want to revisit that when you might get a better chance by playing in the world's most famous arena with Kevin Durant? I really do believe, like you, that both of them are going to end up there. I think the draft lottery situation is going to be interesting. You and I both know that if the Knicks win this thing, the cries in the streets of Fix will be in. I think even more so if the Lakers were somehow to squeeze in with their 0.2% chance or whatever it is. But I don't know what they can do. And I'm wondering, is LeBron, do you think there's any possibility, Tony, that LeBron and his team of agents and handlers and people that feed him figs and everything that's going on, do you think there's any possibility that LeBron is saying, you know what, this was a great plan. This was a great idea. It looked really good. Things didn't turn out the way we thought they were going to happen this year. And then Magic's gone now, and we don't know. Linda Rambis is making decisions now for the organization. Maybe I need to kind of collect my shells and get out of here.
Well, I'll tell you what. You, first of all, your points are on the money, particularly about Christmas Day, because that was both we were talking about. I was talking about baseball, Fresno State baseball, at the end of the Bulldog Hour, and I had mentioned that the odd symmetry of baseball and softball both hitting the apex with national championships and each taking a precipitous drop right then at the apex. It's rare that you get to the top of the mountain and slide right off immediately. Christmas Day was the apex of the Lakers season. They blew the two-time defending champion Warriors right off the court. They blew them out, just blew them away at Oracle. That, however, was the same day that LeBron got hurt. Okay, that was the third quarter. LeBron gets hurt. The Lakers go on to win. But their season, in many respects, was not the same because LeBron had the groin issue. And so you're right in saying that what he could do is he could say to himself, you know, I'm going to look at this Magic thing and say, in reality, what Magic meant to me, even if it was true or not, was that he was the stability, and I would never have left if not for Magic leaving. But isn't that the nice safety Hatchie has right now to blame everything on the departure of Magic, even has nothing to do with it in reality.
It is, it is as valuable as the fact that his contract doesn't have a no-trade clause. That he can't, I mean, there's, and this is going to sound like I'm denigrating LeBron, and I'm not, because I'm not a LeBron hater, nor am I a LeBron supporter. It's just I'm a LeBron observer. But when something goes wrong, LeBron usually is quick to, he speaks very eloquently, but he's very quick to point out this lengthy soliloquy that essentially takes him off the hook. It wasn't me that got David Blatt fired. It wasn't me that wanted all the player transactions,
right.
And so on. We can go right down that list, Tony. And this absolutely is the escape hatch for LeBron James, should this go this way. And then you start, you know, I talked to somebody, not Alan Sliwa, but I talked to somebody else in Los Angeles, pretty well connected, who said, and you've heard this too, and we've all heard this, but that for me to hear this from this particular person, that Jeannie Buss is getting, you know, a number of different people trying to encourage her to just sell the franchise and or trade LeBron to the Sixers. I mean, can you believe that in a year, Tony, we have gotten to this point with the Los Angeles Lakers, a team that has won, what, 16 NBA championships and has, you know, the second greatest, and not by a lot, behind the Celtics, you know, marquee name in the history of basketball, probably the third or fourth in all of sports, along with the Yankees and the Montreal Canadiens.
Well, I'll tell you what, I can see, particularly after what happened with Ty Lue, if it really was that the front office of the Lakers, which you have to read as Jeannie Buss and her subordinates, I don't care whether it's Linda Rambis or Kurt Rambis, whoever it is, if they were insisted upon Kurt Rambis being on that staff, that would tell you that you had ownership of the Lakers not trusting their own superstar LeBron with his handpicked coach Ty Lue, right? That's just basically saying we need a spy there. And that's one of the reasons that Ty Lue said, I'm not doing this. If that's the case, I can see the justification to say we need to trade LeBron. If we don't trust him, if we think that he is so Machiavellian behind the scenes that we can't trust him, then I can see that justification. But you know what we've talked about, CG, about the NFL in particular? We've said, why do guys want to own a National Football League team? Because there's a lot of billionaires, but only 32 of them own NFL teams. The same applies to the NBA. There are a lot of billionaires, but only 30 of them own NBA franchises. I can see Jeannie Buss saying, you know what? It was wrong with LeBron. He's too manipulative behind the scenes. We don't want him, but I'm not giving up what makes my family special.
Yeah.
I could buy the one, LeBron gone. I can't buy the other, the Lakers being sold. I just don't think so.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. One more segment with Tony D.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
A few more minutes with our good friend, Tony Diodato. We lovingly call him Tony D. Tony, I opened the program talking at length about the NCAA selection committee and the NCAA softball tournament invites around the country at the various regionals, and I always feel compelled to point out the fact that, you know, in case there's new listeners, and we always appreciate that, but for people who don't know me, I'm not from here, and I didn't go to Fresno State, so I, you know, even though we're the, obviously the flagship for Fresno State, and you know, no, all full disclosure, we want Fresno State to do well and win, it's not like I am some lifetime homer for Fresno State. I think it's important to point that out, because I think that they really got the short end of the stick in this softball selection. To me, it's downright ridiculous. The only thing that Boise State has on either Fresno State, UNLV, or San Jose State is the fact that their RPI was 40. Fresno State's was 61. San Jose State, 48. UNLV, 46. But, Tony, Boise State went 12-12, 34-15. That was an inferior mark to the three teams that came in second, third, and fourth, not to mention the fact that Fresno State swept them. They battered them this past weekend. UNLV beat them 2 out of 3, and San Jose State swept them. And then you add in the fact that a team like Texas A&M that finished dead last in the SEC. They went 6-18 in conference, 28-25 compared to Fresno State's 36-18 or UNLV's 36-14 or San Jose State's 37-17. They managed to get in. It's nonsense, and I think this is a clear-cut example of yet another tournament selection committee saying, in essence, we think that Boise State has a much more marketable, big-time, recognizable national name versus Fresno State, UNLV, and San Jose State, who really, quite frankly, don't.
Well, I hope you're not right about that.
Me too.
If you are, I mean, there are two different levels of this whole thing, and you know, as you're aware, and you and I've talked about it on and off the air a little bit. You know, I spent I'm so damn old. I get all starts to run together, but particularly from the mid '80s all the way to the start of the 2000s. You know, calling games for that softball program, which went every year. Every year it was, you know, off to Omaha initially, then it was off to Sunnyvale for a couple of years, then in 1990 off to Oklahoma City, and it was just, as we've talked, foregone conclusion, right? Either Fresno State, UCLA, Arizona are going to win the national championship. We used to joke that particularly was in Sunnyvale with the couple of years it was there in 88 and 89 for the national championship. It was like a California invitational. You know, 5-6 of the teams were all from California. That changed when the money started going to the Power Five conferences. The Olympic sports then became gender equity-wise very important. Schools started throwing money at it, and it meant that schools out here that weren't part of the Power Five started to fall back. The Fullertons that won weren't winning anymore. Fresno State hasn't won the way they used to. But you would hope that if you're going to fall victim, you're going to fall victim to the Power Five schools, right? Not to schools in your own conference where you're selecting one over the other. I would hope that this was based upon more sound criteria than, you know, what we've heard of Boise State because their football program is more popular. But, you know, I can't tell you for sure you're not right about that.
Well,
you may be right.
Forgive my interruption. Everything you're saying makes perfect sense. But when I look at this, Tony, I see San Jose State in second, UNLV third, Fresno State fourth. I see, again, three teams that beat Boise State 8 of 9 times. I see one thing in Boise State's favor, and that is an RPI. And I gotta tell you, come hell or high water, it looks like a decision was made. And I'd be saying this about any of these teams if they were 12-12, 34-14, and an RPI of 40. Whether it was Nevada, Utah State, New Mexico, or San Diego State, it doesn't matter. It just happens that it's Boise State. But Tony, I'm telling you, I can't think of anything else that sends Boise State to the Gainesville Regional, because the numbers, my friend, they don't add up. They just don't add up. They have one number in their favor, and that's it. And what that number is, the RPI, what the committee, Tony, is saying, and I'm going to give you the last word on this. Tony, the only thing I can extract from this is that conference play, head-to-head play, doesn't matter.
Well, that is probably true, particularly in Fresno State's case, where you just swept them, but you did it at a time when they might have already made up their minds, right? I talked to Stephen Tremblay about it going into this series. Stephen Tremblay, of course, works at Fresno State Media Relations, and he kind of made it clear that it was fait accompli. Is it the new kid in town and new kid on the block because this is a relatively new endeavor for Boise State? I mean, is that what we're seeing now? You know, I don't know the answer to that, CG. I just know they are not a traditional power. They didn't play softball for a good long time. They played for a while, stopped, etc. I'm confused by it, although I will tell you this, it sort of comes back full circle to what we're talking about, though. If you have fewer berths because of what schools with lesser records in Power Five conferences are doing, then you do have a shrinking field for the have-nots, and that, unfortunately, would be the Mountain West.
Yeah, there's no doubt, and as I said, I get aggravated with this kind of stuff, and I'm speaking as someone who is an alum of a P5 school, but coming to Fresno 5 years ago, and also before that, being in Fargo, it's allowed me a lot of perspective, and it's allowed me to really include much more data relative to Group of Five schools, to FCS in football, and to see that there is a tremendous inequity here. And again, even if you didn't take Fresno State, then how do you pass on San Jose State, or how do you pass on UNLV that's won 4 in a row? and is 36-14 and is rolling along exceptionally well. And the fact, Tony, that both San Jose State and UNLV both had a higher RPI than Texas A&M, and yet they took Texas A&M, the last place team, three games over 500. How do you figure that?
Paul has talked about it with baseball so often that they turn around and take the entirety of the ACC or something,
yeah,
or the SEC,
yes,
on,
yes,
you. You go, wait a minute here. You know, there is inequity. There's no doubt what the conference needs. They need you in front of that committee, and I'm going to see to it from now on. That would be something I'd pay admission for.
Can I fly on your private jet?
Because I know that... Oh, sure. Oh, sure. It's the Flintstone special. You got to run like hell and lift your legs up at just the right time.
Oh, my gosh. You and I having brontosaurus burgers.
Oh, boy, that sounds good right now.
It does. Folks, he's Tony Deed. We're always very fortunate to have Tony join us at 3:35. Today was bonus Tony time on Mondays. Then I joined up with Tony on his great show on Wednesdays at 2:35, and then we tackle the world's email situation on Fridays at 3:05. Sometimes we get an hour, more times than not. This time of year, we get about 20 minutes, but we have a lot of fun doing it. Tony, always a pleasure, and I will see you on Wednesday.
Well, you'll see me on Friday because the future,
oh, that's right,
World Series champions, the San Francisco Giants,
that's
have
right,
my slot on Wednesday.
That's exactly right. So
I'm not going to tell you what year they're going to be the future champions. Well, I believe it's 2014,
yes,
so look it up. So.
It's coming. All right.
Oh, that's in the past. Sorry.
Yes. So. Thank you, Tony.
I'll see you, CJ.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Lakers with our good friend from ESPN Los Angeles, Alan Sliwa. Oh, my goodness. I can't wait to hear what he has to say. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
I don't know how many people have said to me in emails, in person, and in direct messages on Twitter, some version of, CG, what is going on with the Lakers? And I have my theories, I have my ideas, but a person much closer to the situation, I can't even imagine how every day begins for him, is our good friend and a regular on this program, Alan Sliwa. He is the host of Lakers Talk, 7 to 9 p.m. on Mondays on ESPN Los Angeles. Mr. Sliwa joins us right now. How are you, Alan?
Doing good, Christopher. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm full confession, I told our audience earlier that I sent you a text message saying, do you ever go to bed at night just wondering what kind of madness am I going to wake up to with the Lakers tomorrow morning? And you just said in very, you know, very simple three letters, yes. So the Lakers protest, all of what, 22 people that showed up. I thought that was kind of silly because, they're going to get some media coverage, but that's not really going to be anything that's going to get the Lakers' attention. I guess let's start with this. Frank Vogel, nothing wrong with the guy, but and the fact that he's the third choice, that's not really a big deal either. But it's not like he and his coaching background has set the world on fire. Where are you at with that hire? Three things. Where are you at with that hire? The fact that Jason Kidd has been put into the package. It's sort of a package deal here, which that in and of itself has a lot of stuff to it. And then we haven't really heard from LeBron yet. I don't think we're going to hear from LeBron. Where are you at with all of this?
Well, look, we'll start first with Vogel. I don't even know if he was you mentioned their third candidate. Really, you didn't hear that name come up at all. It was, the focus was Ty Lue. The focus was Monty Williams. When Monty Williams took the job, the five-year deal over in Phoenix, all the attention, everybody just assumed, all right, you know what, Ty Lue's probably going to be the best fit anyways. And when that fell, and, you know, obviously there was a lot of media behind that of how the Lakers screw this up, and does Rob Pelinka and Jeannie Buss know what they're doing, and who in the front office is pulling a lot of these strings. We keep hearing the Rambis, Linda Rambis and Kurt Rambis having a big influence on what this organization is doing. I don't know if anybody really thought Frank Vogel would be a candidate to take the head coaching job. And like you mentioned, he had some success in Indiana, had a really, really horrible stint in Orlando, yeah, for 2 years, left there, and the Magic made the playoffs, obviously this past season. So I think there's still a lot of question marks up there. I think it's fair to give the guy a chance. I think it's fair to see how he could eventually do with the Los Angeles Lakers. But at the same time, this isn't a name that anybody thought coming into this offseason, Luke's going to leave and your guy is going to be Frank Vogel. So I think you got a lot of people that are curious to see how that plays out, number one. And number two, you mentioned Jason Kidd. That one to me is that's the one where I'm probably most perplexed. Jason Kidd was pretty much, you know, had to be a part of the deal with Ty Lue. He had to be the part of the deal with Frank Vogel. Why don't you just hire Jason Kidd then? You know, that one was a little kind of surprising how that was important for the Lakers front office to make sure Jason Kidd's there, and I'm sure there's a reason for it. Maybe it's LeBron saying, got to have him. You know, if you can't get the guy that I want, make sure Jason Kidd's included. Who knows what goes on behind the scenes, but that one stood out to me as well.
Let's maybe weave this into it, and it's a moot point now. It's water under the bridge, but I think it bears examination. And that is, so Luke Walton, he was doing a good job, or at least as best as can be expected, and then the injuries hit and what have you, and he tried to recover, and it was just an impossible situation. It was almost untenable. But with Frank Vogel, sight unseen, do you think the Lakers are better today than they were a couple of weeks ago?
That's a good question. I don't think... You know, look, I'll give Vogel this. He's got 8 years of experience. He has been to the Eastern Conference Finals two different occasions with the Indiana Pacers. Are the Lakers better off because of Frank Vogel? We're going to wait and see. You know what? I think it's okay to say, yeah, I think they are better off just because just the sheer experience that Vogel can bring to the table. And, you know, Jason Kidd as an assistant, to have him in, on that, a part of that staff, and we'll see how they round everything up. By the way, there still hasn't been an official announcement from the Lakers that, you know, Frank Vogel is the head coach of the Lakers. So I think they're a little bit better off, but at the same time, we're still dealing with this perception as reality. And the perception is that this Lakers front office doesn't exactly know what they're doing. The perception is that they've been sloppy, for, you know, at least the last couple of months. And typically perception is reality, and I think that is a reality for the Lakers right now.
All right, so we're talking with Alan Sliwa. He is the host of Lakers Talk on ESPN Los Angeles, Mondays 7 to 9. Does just a terrific job with that, and we're always really fortunate and pleased that he takes time out of his day to come and join us here. Listen, you're starting to touch on it, and I was having some fun with it over the weekend, but I was asking quite seriously, what is going on with the Lakers? Because you have Kurt Rambis, you have Linda Rambis, you have, of course, Jeannie Buss. You have Rob Pelinka. You have LeBron James. I'm trying to understand, I've used this often, but it really fits here. This is downright Shakespearean what we have going on here, because it's the classic history play. It's the classic English kings where somebody is sitting on the throne, and all of those around him want that throne, and they'll do whatever they can to get it. In this case, with the Lakers, who do you suppose was the person that essentially pulled the switch and said, this is who we need to have? And I want you to speculate. You started to touch on it a second ago. Do you think LeBron weighed in and said, you're going to bring Frank Vogel in, you better bring somebody in that I'm pleased about, and that's where Jason Kidd got put into the mix?
So I think Rob Pelinka is definitely kind of at the forefront right now, with Magic out of the picture, with the Lakers not replacing that position. So there's nobody that's, you know, president of basketball operations right now. Technically speaking, Pelinka's kind of taken on both of those roles, general manager and president, and he was heading the coaching search. So I do think Rob is in the front of that picture. Now, how much influence does a guy like Kurt Rambis have? How much influence was rumored over the last couple of days that Phil Jackson also was giving his opinion of what the Lakers should do. How much influence they have, to be honest with you, is kind of a question mark. I don't know. I really don't. And I wish the Lakers kind of weren't so secretive of who's doing what. It's just, these are the positions that everybody has, and this is what their role is, but that hasn't been the case for the Lakers. As for LeBron, you know, I think it would be wise for Rob to get LeBron's opinion. This isn't too uncommon in the NBA, probably not too uncommon in sports in general, where you're asking, you know, some of your main guys, what do they think? Especially because the coaching position is so key. I have to imagine, LeBron at some point was at least brought into the conversation to give his opinion, maybe even his opinion of his experience when they used to face, Miami used to face the Indiana Pacers with Vogel. And as you just hit on with Jason Kidd, I don't understand, you know, how Jason Kidd would be a part of the mix unless there was somebody powerful saying, find a way to bring Jason Kidd a part of the mix as well.
Right. So then let's bring all this together. And, again, I'm asking you to do a lot of speculating, but your speculation is much more valuable than mine is because you're a part of this on a daily basis, either directly or indirectly, simply because this is what you do and this is who you cover. A year ago, you and I were talking. And we knew, you knew and I knew, and you were more hesitant to say, but you knew that that LeBron James was coming. And Magic had talked about it's a 2-year master plan, and if it doesn't work out, then you know, then I'll give my resignation to Jeannie Buss. But he did it a year early. Why he did it, he said he wanted to go back and have fun. That's fine. And my goodness, the tweets are troubling. But beyond that, that doesn't matter anymore. Do you think LeBron, as you've come to know this organization with him in it, Alan, is there any chance that LeBron is saying, you know what, I came out here, we had a good idea, we had a plan, things happened, Magic left, we didn't get Anthony Davis, now we're hearing that we're probably not going to get, whether they were serious considerations ever or not, Kyrie's probably not going to come here, KD most likely is not coming here, Clay, their owner, has said, I'm going to make him a warrior forever. Kawhi, the shot may have changed a lot of different things in his thinking. Is it possible that LeBron is going to hint at what we're hearing, whether it's Philadelphia or somebody, that maybe he's going to say, I didn't bargain for this. We'll give it another year and we'll see. Or is he maybe looking, at least exploring the possibility of going somewhere else, even though he is under contract? He doesn't have a no-trade clause. I can't believe this is why he came to L.A. for this kind of chaos.
Well, technically, you know, it wouldn't work for both parties if, you know, obviously if LeBron wanted out or the Lakers didn't bring LeBron James here at the twilight of his career to not make the postseason, to not be competing, at least in the Western Conference, first round, second round, just be a part of the mix. And that's exactly what happened in this first year. Lakers weren't a part of the mix. Once March turned around, Lakers were pretty much already out of the playoff picture. So it definitely hasn't worked as planned in the first year. This second year is very crucial. That's why everybody's pointed at this summer and all those names that you listed off there. And we'll see if the Lakers, you know, what they can do in free agency, number one. I've been continuing to harp on the fact that I don't think a lot of these young players that are on this team will be here by the time, you know, the season rolls around, just because they're desperate to try and win right now. And whatever they have to do, I think they're going to do. So that's why this second year becomes so critical, because if by the time this season ends, the Lakers are still in a similar position, they're not making the playoffs, they're not really making that much progress. LeBron's going to be 35 in December. What is the point of having a LeBron James for what would be technically his final year of his contract, based upon he has that player option in his final year? It really wouldn't have worked for both sides. Lakers didn't bring him over here just so they can kick back and you know, just have a star on the team, because you've seen it, Christopher, and I have as well. Since they got LeBron, they've been crucified all over the media because – it hasn't worked so far. That doesn't mean it can't work. It doesn't mean that it won't work. But to this point, it obviously has been a little bit of a train wreck. This summer is so key, and this second year is so key to seeing what the future is going to be with LeBron and the Lakers.
What do you think is in the mix with Jeannie Buss? Because, I mean, we all know how she got the position in terms of, you know, conquering the kingdom, so to speak. I don't know beyond that how calculating of an owner that she is. I know she certainly gets advice from Phil Jackson, and I'm guessing other people are in her inner circle. Forget agents or anybody else. Whatever is in play with her, she's certainly getting advice from other people. But where do you think she is at right now? Because this is not the Lakers kingdom that she grew up in. She grew up in teams that were almost always competing. If not for championships, they were relevant, they were exciting, they were fun to watch. Fans were, you know, they were a buzz team in town and across the country. When the Lakers came to town, it was like MJ's Bulls, Larry's Celtics, and certainly when Kobe was there and so on. Where do you think she's at with all this right now, Alan?
Popularity is still there. I mean, the team is as popular, I think, as it's ever been when it comes to always having their name in the news, you know, selling out tickets, selling out jerseys. get nationally televised games, the brand, all that is all great and dandy, but that wasn't built off of losing. You know, when Dr. Jerry Buss built this franchise back in the 80s when he bought it in 79, it was about winning. And there's a way to have business and the basketball side merge together and be successful, because that's what Dr. Jerry Buss did. So, you know, a lot of this chatter about, well, Jeannie's been so good on the business side. 6 years they haven't made the postseason. That's not good business. And, you know, think about how much revenue is being lost when they're not in a long playoff run. Think about how much revenue is being lost when your games starting in March are meaningless. If Jeannie's thinking anything, I think what she's saying to herself is, I've pretty much had the helm and been governor of the Lakers for the last 6 years, and she's failed. And you know, I've emphasized over and over again, she wants nothing more than this organization to succeed. She cares about it more than you do, more than I do, more than any of the Laker fans. This is in her blood. But that doesn't mean, as much as she wants it to succeed, it doesn't mean that she's got the results for, you know, the organization, because she hasn't. You know, 6 years in, this team still hasn't made the playoffs, and you know, unfortunately, what her dad left behind is still behind, and nobody's been able to kind of even take a fraction of what he's built and build on it.
Last thing, the NBA draft lottery is coming up, and you and I both know. I was living in New York City when the Knicks won the Patrick Ewing lottery, and I can tell you, because I went to the Garden the next day, and the line at the season ticket, well, the ticket window, but for people to get season tickets, was as long as the main 8th Avenue post office on April 15th. It was unbelievable. The line went down the street, down the block, and then out to 7th Avenue, and down 7th Avenue a couple of blocks. It was incredible. If the Knicks win the playoff, and they've got as good a chance as anybody, of course, you know, yeah, the cries of the fix is in are going to come out. But if the Lakers, who don't have nearly the kind of percentage to win or get the top couple of picks, do you think the Lakers will look to do any kind of packaging of some of their draft choices and some of the young talent they have, maybe a Kuzma or something, to try to move into the top three or four?
No, I don't see them doing that. I really don't. You know, I think, you know, right now the Lakers are probably slated for 10 or 11, right around that, yeah, that area. I think the only thing they do with any of these young players is to go get vets, to go try and get an Anthony Davis, try and get in the sweepstakes for another all-star that's been in the league for a little bit, that has some playoff experience. The draft is going to be good for them that they have a top 10 pick, but I don't think that's something that, you know, they're weighing in on. If LeBron didn't come over and it's still all about the, you know, that process and gaining all this equity with the young players, it's a different story, but I don't think so now.
Quick follow-up. Kawhi Leonard, you and I have talked about him forever. Before he got to Toronto, he made it very clear he wanted to come to Los Angeles. The lean was the Lakers. I said something about this earlier. I think I saw you say something about Kawhi. That shot, he won't ever have to pay for another dinner for the rest of his life if he stays in Toronto. He has etched himself into the legacy of the Toronto Raptors, and it was only a semifinal, a conference semifinal. I've got to believe this gives him or will give him some pause going forward about what he wants to do. But what happens if he decides to come to L.A. and the place that he goes is the other tenant in red and blue in the building? What does that do to the public perception in your area of the Lakers, that he would turn down the Lakers and go to the Clippers?
A powerful statement. It would be a very, very powerful statement. You know that I think already you look at the loss. You look at the Los Angeles Lakers and a lot of the publicity around the team right now, it's negative, you know, and if a guy like Kawhi Leonard, who's, you know, from Southern California, decides that Clippers organization and what they're building there with Steve Ballmer and a consultant like Jerry West and Frank Lawrence as the president of basketball operations, Doc Rivers as the head coach, it would just really put the icing on the cake that the stability is not with the Lakers. The kind of that Showtime allure has kind of faded off, and that even a Clippers organization can outpitch the Los Angeles Lakers. So it would say a lot. By the way, that doesn't mean that there hasn't been
a number of other free agents that haven't come to the Lakers. Because before LeBron, it's been a long time since somebody came over. But I think it would say that here's a player in his prime that wants to spend the next 4 or 5 years with another franchise, not the Lakers.
Folks, he is Alan Sliwa. He's the host of Lakers Talk Mondays, 7 to 9 p.m. on ESPN Los Angeles. You can find him on Twitter, at Lakers Talk ESPN. Alan, always a great pleasure to have you aboard, my friend.
Appreciate it, Christopher. Thanks, man.
Absolutely. Alan Sliwa, this is the CGP. Yeah, just to put a button on what Alan and I were talking about, I really believe, and I have no way of knowing this, but my speculation, I really believe that LeBron stepped in and said, okay, you're going to go with who you're going to go with, but if you're going to bring in Frank Vogel, I want somebody here for offense, and Jason Kidd's out there, I want you to bring him in. If I'm Frank Vogel, I don't know how you coach and you're not looking over your shoulder at the coach in waiting if things don't go well for Frank, because if things don't go well for Frank, Jason's the next man up. Coming up, hour number three. It's a half an hour's worth. Top 5 at 5. I'm coming your way. This is the CGP.
The Top 5 at 5 is sponsored by the Law Office of Josh Lazar and Associates. And now, from Fresno, California, to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, here are your Top 5 at 5 sports talkers of the day.
Top 5 at 5 for a Monday afternoon. By the way, in case you joined us late, where have you been? 5:30, Sharks coverage starts. Game 2 tonight up at the SAP Center. Sharks taking on the St. Louis Blues. It is the Western Conference Finals. Sharks lead that series 1-0, winning 6-3 on Saturday. Top 5 at 5. We hope we can intrigue you just a little bit. Stories that you've probably heard. I'm just looking at all these. Now, I'm guessing that most of you heard the first one. But if you haven't, I did find this interesting, and I did find the promo that he had shot for this equally interesting.
Number one.
We move to Green Bay, and quarterback Aaron Rodgers, a big and outspoken fan of Game of Thrones. Who isn't? But I think, Russ, you and I are maybe the only people in the building who have not watched Game of Thrones. Yep, not watched it. Well, he did confirm in an Instagram post over the weekend that he indeed made a cameo appearance in last night's episode. Go figure. It's the fifth episode in the eighth and final season. And this wasn't a very well-kept secret, as you would imagine. But he had a little reporter's session, a little gathering back on April 23rd. And Rodgers said then to the media that was assembled, I've got a bit of inside information about who's alive in one of the episodes, but I'll share that down the line. He did a promo for the show back in, right near Christmas. And I looked it up today. It was pretty good. He started really well. He started it really well. It got a little bit thinner as he went on. But it was pretty good. There's a picture, though, I've got a picture in front of me of him in his outfit, his costume, excuse me. And as he tweeted out on Instagram, it was just for a few seconds, but I'll always be thankful to have been on the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones. And, he's talked forever. I've heard him mention this before, that he has his 24-hour rule. Says that he doesn't want anybody telling him about it for a full day after the episode airs because, he might not have had a chance to see it, depending on what time the Packers game would be. So that's always been the rule around him. But he did this promo that he shot last year for Game of Thrones. They shot it in this. If you've ever been to Lambeau Field, you know that when you go in, there's a museum and there's this huge atrium. It's remarkable what Lambeau Field used to be and what it is now. They've kept the integrity of the stadium. They really have. But, there's luxury suites and what have you. There's all that stuff's been built, but the integrity of the stadium is still there. Only they've added to it, and it's a magnificent place. If you're an NFL fan, you really need to go to Lambeau Field just once. But they shot this in the atrium, and at the beginning, he introduces himself by saying, "I am Lord Aaron of House Rodgers of Greenwater Bay, the true king in the north." And he did it. He had a little flair. He had a little stuff going on there. He just didn't hold it. Didn't keep up with it. But it was a pretty good job. Now I'm curious, just to watch the episode, not knowing what's going on, just to see if I can pick him out somewhere. I'm guessing he wasn't on a dragon.
Number two.
Well, it's always interesting when teams lose a playoff series and somebody will come out and immediately say, well, you know what, you better blame anybody, blame me. Joel Embiid did that. A lot of this in response to thoughts of their head coach getting Brett Butler getting let go. Brett Butler, thinking of baseball. He said, you know, losing the game that way, last shot after a hard-fought game, I feel like we had a chance. A lot of things go through your mind, and it sucks. I don't know. I can't explain it. It just sucks. But he had a nice embrace with Mark Gasol. And, of course, reporters always ask, well, what did you say to him? What did he say to you? And he pulled away from that. He just said that, you know, I'll be in this moment again. But you have three of Philly's starters, Jimmy Butler, Tobias Harris, J.J. Redick. They're all going to free agents. They're all going to be free agents. Brett Brown, I mentioned that a little bit earlier, that he's going to be under the gun with management because management came out openly in Philadelphia and said that you need to go further. You need to go further about it. And he was asked about his job security, and he said in the press conference after the game yesterday, stuff like that. We've talked internally a lot. The club can respond to that. But Joel Embiid, I don't know that you can put the loss on him. No, he didn't shoot great. He shot 6 for 18, finished with 21 points. But, you know, Jimmy Butler, he shot 5 for 14 and was 1 for 6 from three-point range, and he had 16 points. J.J. Redick was 5 for 11. He had 17 points. I mean, you know, Tobias Harris, he had 15 points in 42 minutes. Nobody really had a great game for the Sixers, and yet they still were right there. But I think going forward, the Sixers, they're as interesting a team to look at as anybody. And I've even heard talk about Jimmy Butler maybe coming to the Lakers. And I'm not a fan. Is he a solid player? A very good player? Yes. I've never put him in the category of great player, franchise-changing player, somebody who, when the game is on the line, he's going to be the guy that wins you the game. I've just never viewed him that way. And I've also viewed him as somebody who very clearly has a history of locker rooms going in the wrong direction. Happened in Chicago, happened in Minnesota, started to happen in Philadelphia. Seems like everything's been fine there. But where if he goes to L.A., do you see him being the right-hand man and taking that role for LeBron? I don't. Not saying that he won't end up there. But the Sixers team is one that hasn't gotten talked about a lot relative to what they're going to look like come training camp. Because conceivably, Butler is gone, Harris is gone, Redick is gone, maybe Brett Brown is gone. And suddenly you're left with Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid and whoever they get in a draft, and maybe they make a trade or two, or maybe a free agent comes there. You know that Kyrie Irving, it's highly unlikely that he's even thinking about Philadelphia when, in fact, New York is beckoning. Kevin Durant's not going to Philly. So, and what's interesting about that even is that Kevin Durant, and I don't want to go off on a big tangent with Durant because I've talked about him forever, but I can't understand what's in a player's thinking when you're on the greatest team in the world, you're on a team that unless they suddenly completely fall apart, even without your presence, as we saw Friday in Houston, this is a team that you can win another couple of championships. And instead, you'd rather go somewhere where you're not given as much criticism, at least in terms of the team you're going to, because they're not already an established winner. You're going to a team that is miserable, an organization that is, it's almost unfathomable to think of, but they're even worse than the team led by James Dolan. And you're willing to go to an organization that even if Kyrie goes there, even if they get Zion Williamson, they're going to compete next year. They're not going to win an NBA title. It'll probably be a couple of years before that would even be in the discussion. And you're going to get savaged night after night if you aren't putting up a double-double or putting up the same numbers you put up in Golden State. No reason to think you wouldn't But the media there is going to be much tougher. I just can't imagine why he would want to leave such an amazing situation here. But maybe what's going on behind closed doors is just untenable for him.
Number three.
Well, in the category of, you know, taking the blame and putting it on yourself, then add Nikola Jokic to the group there. Here's a guy who went out and had 29 points, 12 rebounds, 4 blocks, had a tremendous game, but is saying, they look at me as a leader. They look at me as their best player. So, yeah, I missed those free throws near the end. And in the Portland game, we went to 4 overtimes. I missed a lot of other shots, and I'm supposed to make some of those. And he's taking the blame. He's saying, blame me. I'm the guy. And you can't blame him. He is the reason Denver, as far as I'm concerned, the primary reason why Denver got to where they did. You win as a team, you lose as a team. Michael Malone, the head coach of Denver, said, I got Nikola Jokic in there taking blame for the loss, not his fault. This was a group effort. I think the cumulative effort of 14 playoff games and us asking him to do as much as we asked him to do finally took its toll on him tonight. And, I mean, this is a guy's his playoff debut, and he nearly averaged a triple-double. I mean, you can't fault him. He's doing what guys do. That's why I said the same thing about Joel Embiid. This is what guys do. And I know they mean it. I know they're sincere. When you hear a Jokic talk, when you hear a Joel Embiid talk, you know, you feel it. But this is a team that, you know, on a certain level, it's hard to believe that Denver, the best home record in basketball, couldn't come through. And I just think at this point, Portland was playing better. And that 4 overtime game, didn't you get the feeling that the team that was going to win that game was going to win the series? Even though, you know, they were down 3-2, you still got the feeling that this team, if they could win Game 6 in Portland, which they did, they were going to find a way to go in there and win Game 7. So you see that Portland isn't nearly as battle-tested as the Golden State Warriors, obviously. They aren't the championship team that the Warriors are, obviously. But this is a team that has shown they can go into, at least this year, the toughest home court in the NBA and win a couple of games. And against the Warriors this year, both teams won all their games on their home court. I think it's going to be a great series. The backcourt matchup in this series is going to be fascinating to watch. You know, with Steph and Clay and with McCollum and Lillard, it's going to be great basketball. And obviously, you know, if the Warriors have Durant, I'm picking the Warriors in 5 if they have Durant. Without Durant, I think this goes 7. I think the Warriors still beat them, but I think the Warriors just have too much. And some would say, well, they're going to have an emotional letdown after Game 6. No, that's for other teams. That's not for this team. It's winning time for the Golden State Warriors, and they're not going to be derailed by the Portland Trailblazers, as good of a team as Portland is.
Number 4.
Well, if I can actually turn my page here. So you'll recall Maximum Security goes out and wins the Kentucky Derby, and then 22 minutes later, it did not win the Kentucky Derby. The jockey was Luis Saez, and he has been suspended for 15 racing days by the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission for the way he rode Maximum Security. What we have learned is that, and this is from the ruling, this is part of the language from the ruling, he was cited for, and I'm quoting, failure to control his mount and make the proper effort to maintain a straight course, thereby causing interference with several rivals that resulted in the disqualification of his mount. Close quote. All right, he was represented at this hearing by Ann Oldfather, that's his attorney, and in a film review session with stewards from Churchill Downs, Ms. Oldfather presented a video to them, and she was arguing that the 7th-place finisher, War of Will, and his jockey were actually responsible for the entire incident. I'd have to watch a race again to take a look at that and see if that's even viable, but I still find it odd that the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission, they'll allow a jockey to appeal his suspension, just as Luis Saez and his attorney are doing, but they don't allow a steward's decision on a disqualification of a horse to be appealed. And I have a fundamental problem with that. Just because the what we see happening, even though I think it was the right move, at a minimum, I think the right message being sent is that nobody is above the law, so to speak, and a decision should be allowed to be appealed. Doesn't mean it's going to get turned over, but the process should at least still be in place. Maybe going forward, something like this happening changes that? I don't know. Probably not, because they've been doing this for 145 years. Highly doubtful they're going to change now. But it does seem unusual. So if Saez's appeal isn't successful, he's not going to be able to ride on any track during that 15-day period. And that'll include the dates May 23rd to 27th, May 30th to June 2nd, June 6th to June 9th, June 13th to June 14th. And, I mean, it's, you know, he's had some issues of this kind of thing before with the New York Racing Association. Nevertheless, I mean, this is going to come and go, and that's going to be that. But, you know, I've watched the replay of that a few times, and every time I've watched it, tells me more and more that they got this decision right. I just think the appeal process should be one that is in place and not one that there's no room for an appeal.
Number 5.
John Beilein leaving Michigan. He is going to be coaching the Cleveland Cavaliers. He's been in Ann Arbor for 12 years, had a great run of success in Ann Arbor. I mean, he made that program relevant again. No question about that. Michigan is I said this on Twitter earlier. I think it's an underrated basketball job. There's no question about it. They have a great fan base, obviously. Chrysler Arena, I mean, they pack the place. They play a big-time schedule, obviously big-time conference. They've won a national championship. They're always in the mix doing something every year. Beilein's record, 829 and 468. You don't think about that, but tremendous. He's never been an assistant coach. He was a head coach in high school, in junior college, Division III, II, and then Division I. He led Michigan to two Final Fours, four Big Ten tournaments. Big Ten tournament regular season titles during his time there. And, he is a real offensive innovator, and I think he's somebody who will really do some stuff for the Cleveland Cavaliers. But the Michigan job is going to be interesting to see who is in line. We're going to talk about that with Marty Lenz a little bit later this week. I don't think Michigan's going to make a decision that fast. There's a lot of names that are out there, a lot of names that are under new extensions, new contract extensions. A lot of the names that you would expect are being mentioned. Chris Beard of Texas Tech, he just signed a brand new deal, an extension. Jay Wright of Villanova, why would Jay Wright leave Villanova? He's a Philly guy. He's won two national championships there. Why would he leave? Of course, I said that about Steve Alford with New Mexico, and he left. And, of course, as you would imagine, the Rick Pitino card is being played. Rick Pitino is not going to coach Michigan. That's not going to happen. So there are a number of names, number of more names that are being mentioned out there. Billy Donovan, head coach of the Oklahoma City Thunder. Would that intrigue him? I think it would. You know, he won national championships at Florida, did a tremendous job there. He made the basketball program at Florida as relevant as football. And similar to when Urban Meyer went back to his home area, this wouldn't be Billy Donovan going back to his home turf. You know, that's not where he's from. He's a New York guy, went to Providence. But, you know, he'd be going to a school with a tremendous athletic pedigree. They play for championships there. They don't win as many as schools like Florida and UCLA and so on, but it would be an ideal spot for him. But we're going to talk about that on Wednesday, some of the ideas that are probably floating out there. Certainly a lot less pressure than if you are Jim Harbaugh at Michigan. Top 5 at 5.
More of the Christopher Gabriel program right now on 940 ESPN.
Just a couple of minutes left before we go to Sharks hockey. Fresno State softball did make the NISC. It's postseason tournament, and they're going to be up playing in Nevada. They will be taking on UC Riverside. That's going to be this coming Thursday at, I believe, 7 p.m. The other two teams in that regional are Nevada and Loyola Marymount. And, again, we have tonight coming up in just a couple of minutes, Sharks hockey against the St. Louis Blues. And, of course, the other conference in the Eastern Conference, that playoff series is 2-0 Boston right now. Boston just dominated Carolina in those first two games. I really felt that – that's my pick, so I'm going to stay with them. I really felt that Carolina was a team that they just had a look about them, similar to what Vegas looked like last year. Boston's certainly a good team, and, boy, they have stepped up their game. When they won the first game in that series, really thought that Carolina was going to come back and steal one at TD Garden, but that has not happened. So Boston in a great position, come in, steal a win, and close this series out against Carolina early. It's going to be interesting to see how Carolina responds, because this is really, the first significant adversity that they've faced. Good hockey team, San Jose. I think that, again, it's going to be interesting tonight to see with Joe Pavelski back playing great. They just look really sharp out there. I'm not going to say they look like a different team so much as they're just a little better. You know, they play the same way, but they're just a little bit better when Pavelski is out there. Remarkable that he got back so quick. Of course, you heard that from Dan Rizanowski, voice of the Sharks. We'll catch up with Dan hopefully later this week. I'm hoping that we can catch up with him maybe on Thursday before game three will be Wednesday, will it not? Yeah, and then Friday will be game four? Okay. So, yeah, they're going with every other game, and we were talking about that a little bit earlier with Tony, which is, I think that's a good thing. So we get lots of stuff coming your way. And, again, I am out of here tomorrow. Have a day off. And then on Wednesday, we will be back. We'll be out at the airport. It's going to be the honor flight coming home. It's all Vietnam veterans. It's going to be very, very interesting and exciting to watch how that all unfolds out at the airport. We'll be there. We'll be coming on live after the Giants game. And then we'll take it to 5:30 when Paul Leffler takes over, 5:30 to 6 for Honor Flight. And, of course, all the festivities and things that happen, Paul is still there emceeing the whole function. All right. Fun show today, as always. My thanks to Tony D and Alan Sliwa and my guy Russ doing his usual great job. Folks, we'll see you in 21 and a half hours. Well, no, we'll see you a day in 21 and a half hours, somewhere in there. The whole math thing. Until then, you're on your own.